up.
You're out of order.
I want to be a lawyer just like you.
You're out of order.
Good for you, son.
The whole trial is out of order.
If there's one thing America needs,
they're out of order.
It's more lawyers.
Oh.
Welcome to the show. This is Jack Wilczek, and you're listening to Legalese on Independent Talk 1100 KFNX. All right, today on the show, I have in studio Representative John Kavanaugh in the Arizona Legislature, who serves District 13. I guess with the redistricting, you may know that as District 8 if you follow these things. Basically, Scottsdale, Fountain Hills. And I think he's been in there since 2007. Representative Kavanaugh is chair of the Appropriations Committee and a member of the Government Committee. He's also professor of criminal justice at Scottsdale Community College and director of the Administration of Justice Studies and Forensic Science Program. John served 20 years as a police officer with the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey Police Department. He retired as a detective sergeant. He has a master's degree in government from St. John's University and a PhD in criminal justice from Rutgers. He's also a military veteran. John and his wife, Linda, have been married for over 30 years and have two sons. John, with that storied introduction, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me here. And just two quick additions. Fort McDowell, the Native American community, is now in my district. They requested that to the Redistricting Commission because I had worked closely with them when I was on the Fountain Hills Town Council. And my wife is the mayor of Fountain Hills now. So
there you go.
We are the power couple, three levels down from the Clintons and six steps to the right.
And also, you're commonly known, like myself, as Jack. That's your nickname.
No, John.
John?
Just John.
Oh, I thought you were Jack Kavanaugh, too.
No.
I'm just thinking of myself. I'm John Wilczek, but then my nickname is Jack, so... All right, there I go, just always thinking about myself. All right, we've got a lot to talk about here. I think number one, you're telling me that the governor just signed into law a bill yesterday, or today, very, very recently, to change the law we have in Arizona that says that in order to run for one office, you have to essentially step down from your current office. So tell the audience what that change is.
Yeah, that's called the resign to run law, and it says that unless you are in the last year of your term, if you say I'm running for a different term or do certain other actions, you immediately have to resign your current office. The theory being that you can't serve in an office and run for another office.
I never understood what the theory was behind that.
There's no theory. In fact, I tried to find out why this was passed. And I had to go to some of the really old lobbyists, used to be legislators. And the nearest I could get was that there was one guy who was speaker who didn't like somebody else who was going to run for corporation commission. And to stick it to him, he got this law passed so that if he wanted to run, he'd have to resign.
Was this like back in the 1800s or was this even of recent vintage? Or?
Yeah, I think like 20, 30 years ago, which by Arizona historical standards was the 1800s because, I mean, let's not forget, we live in a state where we consider an historic landmark to be a movie theater built in the 70s.
Exactly. You know, I had a cousin who came to visit. He lives in the Netherlands. He's actually getting married to my cousin, so he's not a member of my family. He is from the Netherlands. And so I took him on a tour of Phoenix, and we drove by the Capitol building. This is when we had the centennial, so there's a big banner up. It's at 100 years. And he said to me, oh, that is so funny. Where I'm from, you know, it's the post office is older than 100 years.
That's right. No urban renewal, thank God. Yeah. And, of course, I love the design of our Capitol. The Capitol building itself is a nice, historic-looking building, mm-hmm. something to be proud of. And apparently, I guess in the 60s, they decided to build a house and a Senate using the architectural decor of a Hotel 6. it looks like a Hotel 6. Both of them do. It's ridiculous. And then to add insult to injury, they build a modern tower for the governor's office behind it. So
right.
It's like totally, I guess, the gorgeous mosaic architecture. It's bizarre.
Yeah. All right. So, I never understood what the point was behind that.
Yeah.
And I guess there probably isn't one. Probably just one of those historical, strange things we have.
Well, let me explain the story. Under current law, before mine was signed, right, if you were in office and you were not in your last year, if you said, I'm running for this other office, you had to resign. You were allowed to do the following. And you didn't have to resign if you formed a campaign committee, exploratory or regular. You didn't have to resign if you ran fundraisers for the office for yourself. You didn't have to resign if you went around with a petition and collected signatures for yourself. But if you were stupid enough to tell the people the truth, then you had to resign. So everybody would say, I'm seriously possibly considering maybe running for You know, insert office.
You know, it reminds me when you try to prosecute somebody for an attempted crime. You know, you can go all the way up to the point where they actually, you know, do something to attempt to commit the crime. So it's kind of a similar.
it made us be disingenuous and look a little ridiculous putting all these hedge words on. Although you're a lawyer, so you don't mind hedge
words. I'm happy with hedge words. I make a living out of hedge words. But all right, so you got rid of that silly business where you had to say, "Oh, I'm exploring," or not even. I guess just, you know, I'm possibly thinking about running.
Maybe.
So what is the change going
to
be?
Well, now you will have to resign if you do the one thing that really gets the wheels rolling, and that is if you submit the signatures that you collected to get your name on the ballot. That's a real serious move, and then you would have to resign.
Okay, so you can pretty much wait up until I guess a few months before the election, or whenever you choose. To do that, at least you don't have to lie to people, is your point, and tell them.
It was just a silly law.
Yeah.
A silly law.
Okay. All right. Well, that's of course, like any other law that won't go into effect now for another 90 days from the end of the legislative session.
Right. This might not go into effect for several years based on the pace of the current budget negotiations.
Okay. Exactly. All right. So that's big news. What other big news do you have coming out of the legislature?
Well, I guess the biggest thing is the conflict over the expansion of Medicaid. The governor surprised a lot of people when she came out for the expansion, certainly surprised almost all the Republicans. And frankly, we don't like it. All the Democrats, of course, love it, so she only has to get a handful of votes in each chamber. She probably has the votes in the Senate because they only have a three-person party edge there. But the votes aren't there in the House, particularly if we do it the right way and we require a two-thirds vote. Then she probably hasn't got votes in either chamber. She's not really negotiating the budget at this point because there's a fiscal impact on the Medicaid expansion that has to be resolved before you can really finalize the budget. So, and I think she's kind of running the clock, because she's made statements like, you know, I hope nobody has a cruise, reservations and what have you.
Right.
So, I think in the end it will not pass. I believe in the end that there will not be the votes in the House. It's hard to believe any Republicans would vote for this. I mean, we've spent the last 6 years railing against Obamacare, railing against massive debt at the federal level, and to now do a 180, we would need expanded access for the spinal damage it would do to ourselves, that kind of a pivotal turn. You know, the federal government is running a little over $1 trillion deficit each year. We have a national debt now that's pushing $17 trillion. When you add to that the unfunded liabilities the federal government has for Medicare, Social Security, and public employee pensions, total U.S. debt is about $82 trillion. 550% of GDP. Can you say Greece? Can you say America, second-rate power? Can you say that we're saddling our children with this debt and we're about to indenture our grandchildren? I certainly can't back something like that.
So for anybody in the audience who hasn't been following this, you know, very closely, that's the crux of the argument there is that, you know, if we go along with this, we're bankrupting the federal government, which, you know, in the end hurts us anyway.
Right. And of course, as everybody knows, it's not As goes Arizona, so goes the nation. It's as goes the nation, so goes Arizona. And we will sink with the ship. And the governor makes the correct argument that in the short run, this is good for Arizona because it does pump in $1.6 billion a year into the medical community, but you're bankrupting the country. And in the end, the whole ship sinks. And the way that the financing is being done is what's called a bed tax assessment. The Simpson-Bowles Bipartisan Federal Budget Reduction Commission characterized that as a gimmick which is bankrupting the country that has to end. The Wall Street Journal called it a long-running scam. And what they do is you put a tax on hospitals to raise money that you then invest in more Medicaid spending, which gets a 2 times the match from the federal government, and all the money goes back to the hospitals. So it's a tax not to actually pay for anything, but to generate more federal matching funds to bring down more money for spending. That's
right.
Why it's a scam and it's bankrupting the country, and it's the foundation and the funding mechanism for this expansion, which is just one more reason why it's just bad economically and bad politics.
Just short-term thinking.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm talking to Representative John Kavanaugh of District 13, Fountain Hills. And we come back, we'll keep talking about what's hot here in the legislature. This is Jack Wilinchek on Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX.
was gambling in Havana.
Welcome back to Legal Easy, your host Jack Wilczek on Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX. And I'm talking to John Kavanaugh, who I have here in studio, who's a representative of the Arizona Legislature, serving District 23, Fountain Hills. Welcome back to the show, John.
Oh, great to be back.
All right. Let's talk about some of the other big issues here in the legislature. You mentioned to me off the air that there's a bill that you helped, that you assisted with, that has to do with mental illness or mm-hmm. with blocking. There were certain restrictions on police and dealing with people with mental illness.
Yeah, and that was my bill. Following the tragic Newtown shooting, I decided to take a look at some of the state statutes. And having been a police officer, I used to use a section of law which allows police officers, when they come upon somebody who they have reason to believe is a danger to themselves, suicidal, or others, violent, due to mental illness, it allows police officers to take those persons into custody, even against their will. But instead of going to jail, these people are taken to a hospital.
Right.
And in Arizona, we have special medical receiving facilities, mental receiving facilities for these. And they're evaluated by a physician who either lets them go
right.
or can possibly hold them for another like 2-3 days.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And then they make and then they go to a judge and they get a decision either to commit them or they get released. And they have an attorney and what have you present at that point in the system. Well, I discovered that in our law, it said that the police officer had to make that determination based upon his or her own personal observations and could not take the word of people who witnessed it. Now, that's ridiculous for two reasons. Number one, I can lock somebody up for murder based on the statements of witnesses.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's not like, you know, cops' words are no good. So there was no reason for that restriction. But the other more interesting reason is people who are mentally ill, who often have been institutionalized before, that they become what are called institutionalized people, where they become socialized into the ways of mental hospitals. And they very often will become very sedate and very calm whenever they see a uniform, because they associate that with discipline and you
right,
calm
right,
down.
Right.
So with that restriction, the minute the police car rolls up, the person would immediately stop the behavior. Even if they weren't conditioned, a normal person, you know, who's fairly lucid would know you don't do something, you know, in front of a cop.
Yeah.
And then the cop would not be able to take him into custody. So I just passed the law to delete that requirement for a personal observation and let police do the same thing they do for all activities, rely on reliable witnesses. And police are trained to see if a witness is reliable. You know, is the witness crazy? You know, does the witness have an alternative motive for getting this person in trouble? I mean, cops do this all the time. And then I also put into statute a requirement for police training on recognizing and handling severely emotionally disturbed people so that we can pick these people up and get them into a hospital for screening before they, you know, no pun intended, you know, go ballistic, you know, on the street.
Yeah. No, it seems kind of common sense. A lot of people with mental illness can, you know, act fine one moment and to one person and then mm-hmm. not the next. So. And again, as you pointed out, you can use that kind of evidence to support a murder charge. So, why not getting somebody committed?
And by the way, and that person's not being sent to jail. I mean, you're taking the person to a medical facility. So it's not like they're behind bars and they're going to be held for days,
right.
you know, for an arraignment.
Although, as you point out, I think that may be a certain weakness in the law to begin with, is that they can only be put into a hospital for a couple of days under the law, at which point they get discharged. So I've always wondered myself, I don't know how much good that really does.
Well, what happens is the doctor who's examining them, if that doctor believes that he wants a couple more days, he can fax over a form with a statement to a judge who can give a judicial order for another 72 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, they have to schedule a hearing, and the person has an attorney, and there's a determination of whether or not to actually commit the person for treatment. And it could be a commitment to confined inpatient treatment or even outpatient treatment, depending upon the state of the person.
Okay. All right. Last week on the show, we had on Senator Al Melvin, who just announced he's running for governor. And we ended up talking about how, there's a report recently the Colorado River is endangered. You know, I made the point that I'm not really sure what endangered means because, I don't think the river is going away. I assume it means we're going to max it out. And, I was just saying to you off the air that, I think that you were on the Water and Agriculture Committee, and this is something you're a little knowledgeable about. What we ended up talking about last week was that, Senator Melvin, suggested that in the long term we could do something like trading Arizona's, you know, we could build more nuclear power plants or just even use the existing, you know, nuclear-generated electricity and trade it with Mexico, and then Mexico would build like a desalinization plant. Have you ever heard that idea before?
Yeah, well, we actually have a desalinization plant near the Mexican border because when the Colorado River water gets that far down, it's really heavily laden with salts and
right,
what have
right.
you. But it's very expensive. It's a very expensive process.
Yeah.
And water is kind of strange. Because a lot of people don't understand that a larger part, I think even the majority of the water that's used in Arizona is for agricultural purposes. And it's actually the agricultural interests that own the water and have precedence over the rest of us, because when these deals were cut, it was all ranchers that had the water rights.
Right, right.
And that's why when people, you know, see that a large farm is being converted to homes, they get all upset about all the extra water. And that's not actually true, because the land probably already has water rights to take care of all those homes. What I find funny is the actions of certain municipalities like Tucson, which are, you know, kind of more like liberal, where they passed these unbelievably draconian water conservation laws, which are ridiculous in the first place, because so now, you know, instead of having like a 1.5-gallon toilet that you flush once, you now have a 1-gallon toilet you have to flush twice. You know?
Right.
But that's water conservation, you know? You know. And then you try to, you know, rinse your hands, you know, with the equivalent of 5 water pistol, you know, streams in the sink. You know, that just annoys you. But here's the problem with that. See, there's so much water, and developers need to have water, an assured water source before they can build a development.
Right.
So they have to find a place to buy the water. And there's, you know, available water they can go and they can buy. Now, when municipalities like Tucson do this ridiculous conservation, they're not saving the water. The water that they save, you know, with their 1-pint toilet bowls or their totally waterless urinals, that saved water doesn't go into a big reservoir under Tucson. So if there's a major drought, Tucson will have water because they were like the ant, I guess. I forget who was this, the grasshopper and the ant. One of them was frugal.
But, you're drawing my knowledge of Aesop's fables, which is
but that water is not being banked anywhere for them. What they do is they free up the water. It stays in the unused water pool. So when some big developer wants to put 300 homes, you know, on the outskirts of Phoenix, they can buy the water and build the homes. It is the most self-defeating, ridiculous thing. Mm. And this occurred to me the first time when I was talking to a water resources guy for the city of Phoenix. And I said, we do all this conservation, and I go to Phoenix, and, like, you flood whole neighborhoods with water to irrigate.
Right.
And he goes, yeah. I said, well, aren't you concerned about conservation? He goes, no. He goes, we want to make sure that we maintain our water allocation. Because if we didn't do that, then that water would be sold to a developer, you know, out in, you know, whatever. Some of the outlying regions. And we would have no water. And then, if there was a drought, instead of having this water, which we could simply then let people use for flushing toilets, we would be telling people, flush your toilet every other time. So ridiculous conservation, which just annoys people. It annoys the average person and makes conservationists feel, you know, self-righteous and good, doesn't help. It actually makes development go faster.
Yeah, remember we touched on that last week, and, you know, we had on a guest who was from the Arizona State, Department of Water, basically, and he was saying that the use of water in people's lawns is something, a reservoir in and of itself, because, you know, if they have to cut back on water, then I guess the water will stay in the lawn and it's already in the plants. It's not that big a deal.
Yeah, it's a much better to have a no-watering day than a no-flushing day.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I told that guy, as long as we don't get to the point where, like in California, you know, I have little notices in the hotels that say, you know, please limit your use of drinking the water, you know. As long as we don't get to that point, I think we're doing something right. So.
Yeah, I like the thing, put this label down and we won't wash your sheets and towels for a week.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. I'm paying like $180 a night so that you don't do any cleaning here.
As long as we're not rationing off water, I think we're doing pretty good. All right, we got just about a minute here before the break, but I'm talking to John Kavanaugh, who's in the Arizona legislature, representative there. And, you know, one thing we do have to touch on in our next two breaks is you are a victim of the latest craze, the latest trend. of trying to recall elected politicians. So we'll talk about that. There's the music. We'll get to that there here in our next couple breaks. This is Jack Wilinchek on Independent Talk 1100 KFNX.
I'm hiding in Honduras.
Welcome back to Legalese, your host Jack Wilinchek on Independent Talk 1100 KFNX. And I'm talking to here in studio John Kavanaugh, who's representative in the Arizona State Legislature. John, welcome back to the show.
Once again, a pleasure to be back.
All right. Before I went to the break there, I promised we'd talk about how you're the victim, as I say, of the latest craze, the latest trend, and I think it's hitting people on both sides of the aisle equally, which is recalling elected officials. You know, I'll let you talk about that and the reasons that you feel that you're being that there's a movement to recall you.
All right, but I am not a victim. I am not into that victimhood thing, you know.
Right.
I mean, if I get mugged, I'll be a victim, you know, something like that. But other than that, I'm not a victim. Yeah, it's a funny story. It's because of two bills that I ran. One the governor signed already. I've discovered, if I read the newspapers, I do a lot of bills because I read the paper, and I say, that's ridiculous. There ought to be a law. And then it dawns on me that I'm a lawmaker and I can do it.
Right.
So I do a lot of laws that way. And since I read a lot, I do a lot of lawmaking.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot to annoy you. But this one situation involved the Arizona Students Association. Like 20, 30 years ago, the students at all three universities voted to dedicate like a $1 a year mandatory student fee to this outside, like 501(c)(3), whatever it is. And the idea being that they would lobby on behalf of students. And over the years, the fee increased to $2, and then it became every semester.
It's starting to sound a little bit like a union, yeah.
Yeah. So now they're collecting this mandatory fee, and they're supposedly lobbying for the interests of students. And I didn't get involved in that point, even though I don't like mandatory fees for things other than essential student services.
Right.
But then I read in the newspaper that this group actually donated over $100,000 to the Vote Yes campaign for the sales tax initiative to fund extra education last November. And I said, they're taking mandatory student fees and they're making donations to election campaigns. And by the way, that initiative failed big time, so it wasn't even popular by a lot of students. I said, they've crossed the line. And I said, and the university has crossed the line because they're using university resources to collect that money. And you cannot use government resources to promote elections. I can't go to my office and make fundraising calls on my office phone because I got to use my own private phone.
Right.
So I just simply passed a bill that said, I passed a law that said they couldn't do that. And then the region said, hey, we're going to ban the practice. So I said, okay, I'll back off. And the regents ban it. And then these students double down on dumbness, and they sue the regents with the same money to stop the ban. I said, what the heck with that? So I ran the bill that basically says, you know, that you can't take mandatory student fees and give it to this outside group to do it. And it passed both houses, and the governor signed it. So now this student association will have to rely on voluntary donations.
Right.
You know, they said, how we do? I said, get a coffee can, and paint it red.
Like
and
everybody
get
else.
Yeah, get your little table. They're going to probably raise, I'm thinking 38, 40 bucks next year. So they're finished. Right? They're, no one's
going to
donate.
Students that learn how to do it, right? It's good for them too.
So one of the people who's doing the recall was the secretary of the group, who I think was salaried too. You know, we discovered that they were all like on salary and stuff.
Yeah.
So that's one part of the group. The other person is one who objects to my so-called bill that I passed in reaction to Phoenix's so-called bathroom bill.
Yes, let's talk about the bathroom bill, please.
Okay, but let me on the recall though. I don't even know what they're going through with it because they went to the Secretary of State, they filed the paperwork, and they got the form, which basically says they've got to get like 17,000 signatures by July 23rd. Which means they got to collect probably about 20,000 because every signature in a recall is actually verified by the recorder's office. And I have yet to hear of anybody seeing anybody with a petition collecting it. So
you
just
don't think they're serious about it?
I don't. I mean, if it happens, I'll run. I have no problem. I've been reelected. I've been elected three times to this office, and you know, I intend to keep getting elected until I'm carted away. You know, but so one more election won't hurt me. But so I don't think it's that serious. But the bathroom bill, yeah. The city of Phoenix decides to pass an expanded civil rights ordinance. And it has to do with the usual areas of civil rights coverage, you know, housing, employment, you know, access to, you know, stores and shops and what have you, jobs. And then they add access to bathrooms and other such facilities with an expectation of privacy, i.e. showers and locker rooms in public pools and in private health clubs. And stuff
I didn't
like
realize
that.
So this is kind of going back to, I know there's an incident a year or two ago where somebody went to a restaurant in downtown Phoenix and was harassed. Okay, so as a consequence of that, the city of Phoenix, you know, started the gears rolling on the anti-discrimination bill in general. Okay, I didn't make that connection. So this was kind of a result of that.
Well, I don't know. It's something which kind of floats around left-wing circles and, you know, yeah. Tucson did it a while back.
Okay.
So the bottom line is, and of course, when they had the hearing, all they would speak about was bathrooms. And usually when you're in a compromising dress position, you're in a closed stall in the bathroom. So it's not super critical. Although, frankly, people are uneasy when people of the opposite sex are in a one-sex bathroom. We've all had the experience where you're rushing and you're in a restaurant or a stadium and, you know, and you walk in and you say, wow, what a strange restroom. There's no urinals, you know. And then you suddenly see a woman, you know, down the end, you know, and you get the deer in the headlights look and you run out hoping nobody saw you. I mean, that's our customs, our mores. That's the way we are. And people are uncomfortable. But see, it goes beyond restrooms because this bill also covers showers, you know, in a health spa, Gold's Gym, or locker rooms. And you can have a situation where a transgendered person, and this law defines a transgendered person as a person of one sex, biologically, who in their mind believes they're the other sex. Well, the problem is, when the mind part goes into the restroom of the opposite biological part, you can have a situation where you have a stark naked man standing next to a 10-year-old girl. I said, this is not acceptable.
Right. So, I guess the big part of that is that it's very fuzzy when you're saying, you know, in his mind he thinks, because he gets to argue, well, you know, I think I'm a woman. And then it's arguably, at least the argument can be made that he's okay under that bill.
Yeah. And the bill says that's transgendered, and what they think is what they are, and that's where they can go. So, and you have a situation right now in a university in the state of Washington where a college has a swimming pool, gym, and shower area, and they rent time to a local high school girls' swim team and even an elementary school swim team. And in the ladies' locker room and shower, there is a transgendered person who in his or her or whatever's mind is a raving, you know, beauty, but who biologically is all male, all naked in front of these young girls. And that's not right. And what the Phoenix ordinance does is it says if a store owner dares to have gender-specific private facilities like this and questions somebody, then the store is guilty of a crime, and it sets up the ability for the person who's told to leave to civilly sue the person. So I initially overreacted. I confess that. I said, let me counter this by simply making it a misdemeanor to intentionally go into the restroom of the opposite sex, except for certain exceptions like helping a child or what have you.
Right.
I withdrew that, and I said, all I'm going to do is preempt local governments from passing laws that make it a criminal act or create civil causes of action for stores that dare have separate men's and women's facilities and enforce it. So that's all my bill is now. Okay. And it'll probably come forward in a week or two. We're feeding bills out slowly because we're in slow-mo with the legislature because of our disagreement with the governor on the budget and Medicaid.
Yeah. All right. Well, we just have a couple minutes here before the break, but I love this. I was telling you, I love this bathroom bill because any way you approach it, it's just very funny to me. but you're saying right now that the way your bill stands is that it would just preserve a person's right to have, I guess, what's kind of the status quo, and just have regular male-female bathrooms.
Exactly. Or unisex. Under my bill, you can have a unisex facility. You know, if you want to have a unisex shower, you know, then, you know, if anybody actually wants to go in there, you know, although they had some of those in Times Square and stuff, you know, back when I was a cop there and it was a degenerate, you know hellhole, you know, I'm sure they had like, you know, unisex showers and what have you. But
you know, I was telling you off the air, a real good buddy of mine came to visit from Israel one time and we went out to a bar and he gets up to go to the bathroom And he comes running back with some bouncer chasing him. And I ask him, what's going on? He says, and the bouncer says, well, you know, your friend here tried to go into the women's bathroom. And my friend says, well, in Israel, all the bathrooms are unisex. I didn't know. So, you know, I guess part of this is just cultural. I don't know. But anyway, well, all right, this is Jack Wilczek. I'm talking to John Kavanaugh from the Arizona House. And this is Legalese on Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX. Hey, welcome back to the show. This is Jack Wilczek on Legalese Independent Talks, 1100 KFNX. And I have in studio here John Kavanaugh, who's in the Arizona House of Representatives. Welcome back to the show, John.
Oh, pleasure.
All right, before we went to the break there, we finally broached the subject of the bathroom bill, which I love talking about because I just think it's very funny. You know, what I'm saying is, in a lot of ways, it's really just a cultural issue, and you know, I don't know if there's necessarily anything wrong with sharing a bathroom with people of the other gender. But the big point you're making here is that this is not really just a bathroom bill. It has to do with locker rooms. And a locker room really is a whole different situation because there people are.
And showers, because you know, you got the so-called full Monty.
That sums up the argument right there. You got the so-called full Monty in a shower.
And I don't want to see I don't want to see other males in the full Monty, much less a transgendered person.
Okay. All right. So that's that. We'll move on to more pressing matters of state here. You know, some of the other issues I just want to touch on here with you. I know that I think you're opposed to the governor's proposed sending $77 million, I have written down here, to Child Protective Services. Can you explain your position on that?
No, we don't have really any real issue with that. We gave them a few extra $1 million just recently because there was an emergency need. I don't know if 77 is the correct number because we're doing our own analysis. And when as part of this overall package, which is not just foster care, but it's more caseworkers, it's more attorneys, we believe that the cases will be adjudicated much faster, thereby reducing the need for the foster care. Mm-hmm. So I think they're going to get a substantial amount. It might not be the full amount the governor is talking about, but it'll be pretty close because nobody's really arguing that CPS doesn't desperately need money. But I think there could be a cultural issue there too, and I think we did address that a little bit by trying to get more law enforcement minded people in as the caseworkers in serious cases, because CPS workers have the same kind of a conflict that probation and parole officers has, because they wear two hats. On the one hand, they are social workers that are trying to reform and help the person, but on the other hand, they're law enforcement because use the stick to make the person comply with the not only the terms of probation but the rehabilitation efforts. And in some cases, if the social worker takes over and trumps the law enforcement person, you might have somebody maintain custody of a child and the child gets, you know, abused or hurt. So in some cases, maybe erring on the side of a law enforcement versus the social worker might be more appropriate.
Right. Might end up saving some money, I guess, and getting the job done. All right. We'll move on to another subject here. What's your position I know you have some strong positions on immigration. Let me ask you, do you have a position on young minor immigrants or things like the Dream Act?
Yeah, I deviated from a lot of the other hard. I'm a hardliner on illegal immigration. I helped write PUTTA 1070. I traveled the country defending it. I'm totally opposed to amnesty. I don't like the present bill. I think it's amnesty. However, even back in the heydays of 1070, I never had a problem with the so-called Dream Act. Mm-hmm. In other words, somebody who was brought here as a young child, who grew up here, socialized here, might not even speak the language of their original country that parents brought them from, certainly don't have the cultural, you know, savvy, and I'm not going to, you know, pick them up and kick them over the fence into a strange country. That would be cruel. Mm-hmm. So as long as, you know, we're screening out criminal types, and as long as we're talking about people who were brought here when they were young, I don't have a problem taking care of them. But the parents who brought them here and the adults who came, adios. The one agreement I have with Senator McCain and Senator Flake is they should go to the back of the line. The problem is, for me, the back of the line is in the home country, because right now there are 4 million people on waiting lists in countries all over the world who want to come here legally. That's where the line is. So I have no problem taking these people and putting them on the back of the line.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting way of looking at it. You know, I have a lot of fierce debates with my girlfriend who's from Mexico, and she immigrated here legally. She just became a citizen a couple months ago. And that's a pretty interesting way of looking at it, because she did. She waited. Her family had been applying for her to come to this country since she was 6 years old. She didn't get the visa and then legal residency until she was 16. So you're right. There is a giant line of people waiting outside the country, basically. Mm-hmm. It's interesting way of looking at it. I mean, it's in a way.
Well,
go ahead.
I mean, you know,
it's unfair to them.
It's a first run movie. You know, it's like, you know, the Star Wars 18 or whatever, and you're out there in front of the Cine Capri, right? one or two, you know, I mean, you're sitting there for like 2 hours because you got there early, you want a good seat, and you're right in the front of a line, and the 15-year-old assistant third manager of Hawkins Theater comes with his cummerbund and leads the line, and you open the door, and the theater's already full because the fire door was open and everybody snuck in.
Yeah.
And then the little, the third assistant manager in the cummerbund says to you, well, I'm sorry, you can't get in. We throw these people out, but, you know, they've been here a while. They're comfortable in the seats. And, you know,
yeah.
You know.
It's unfair to people who've been waiting to do it legally. All right. Let me ask you, though, you know, the proposals that this Gang of Six have been coming out with, I've heard a lot of criticism because there's not enough provision there for guest workers. I'd be curious to know your thoughts on that and just the idea of a guest worker program in general. And
well, first of all, you don't have to have a guest worker program associated with an amnesty program. They're two entirely different things. All through the 1070 debates and the employer sanctions, I never opposed a guest worker program. In fact, a guest worker program is a win-win for the U.S. and whatever country they're coming from, and most would probably come from Mexico because of its proximity. When you have a guest worker program, these individuals come here only for a short period of time. Some of them, like in Yuma, you know, they come in the daytime, they go home at night. Those that live further away might come here for 3 months, then they have to go home for 3 months before they can come back. And the importance of that is they maintain roots in their original community, and they stay with their family. And they earn money, they bring it back to their country, which is often a poor country, and they use that money to improve their poor country. Maybe they open a store, they build, you know, they improve their house. That's how you help both countries.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to letting them sneak into the country and stay here, letting them marry here or cheat on their wife here and have kids here. We've broken up families mm-hmm. in foreign countries by this current practice. So guest worker program, and by the way, you can screen guest workers. You can control the number so that you don't have too many workers and you don't dilute the wages of our workers. You can bring in the types of workers that you need. We do not need 11 million people whose average education is 10th grade. Because the very simple fact of the matter is that a person with 10th grade education uses up far more public benefits than they contribute through taxes. In fact, they don't pay taxes. And that's one of the jokes of this new latest amnesty program. We're going to make them pay all their back taxes. They're going to earn this. If you have a 10th grade education, if you're a landscaper, guess what? You don't pay taxes. Even if you're reporting, you don't pay. In fact, you probably get earned income. We'll probably be giving these people money to get amnesty.
No, I have read that, yeah, that's kind of weak because they may not owe taxes to begin with. And just because it would be very difficult to go back all those years.
Yeah. And let's give them a $2,000 fine, which is less than they paid the coyote to smuggle them in. There's another real, ow, slap on the wrist.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, this is kind of the discussion I always have with my girlfriend, who, again, is a Mexican citizen. It's, on the one hand, I mean, the immigration system now is broken. I've heard a lot of American businesses that criticize even this proposal by the Gang Six, saying, you know, they're not going to let in enough guest workers. We do need people here to do work. But on the other hand, I think there's a very real opposite argument at the other end of the spectrum, which is that, you know, if we threw open the borders, you know, I've been to Tijuana and it's not pretty.
Yeah.
I don't want to see Tijuana suddenly move into Phoenix. So I think, you know, as with any other issue, there's got to be a happy medium somewhere in the middle where you let in enough people that, you know, we've got the workers that we need and you keep out, you know, Tijuana.
Oh, no, I like guest worker program. I never post. In fact, you know, this whole illegal immigration thing where you legalize the 11 million people who are mostly from Mexico and South America because of their proximity is so anti diversity that Senator Ted Kennedy introduced. Back in the 80s, almost everybody who came here legally were from Europe. It was a white immigration system. And they said, this isn't right. We should have diversity. And Kennedy passed a bill that now has people from all over the world. Every continent gets to have people. That whole system is thrown off kilter when you have 11 million people, almost all, the overwhelming majority are from Mexico and Guatemala and a few other countries. I mean, that destroys the diversity these people claim to worship.
Yeah, so again, you're saying it's unfair to the immigrants who've been waiting, say, in other countries around the world to get into the country. Right, it's an interesting argument. I'll bring that up with my girlfriend tonight and see what she thinks. I can't promise I'll make any headway there.
Yeah, do it after dinner, so, so you don't starve.
There you go. All right, well, the time we got left, we should talk about medical marijuana real quick here. I've got something to ask you here that my producer wrote. It says, cancer patients who receive chemotherapy or radiation treatment seem to benefit from medical marijuana. Why do you oppose its use? So I'll put that question to you.
Because the FDA disagrees with your producer. Look, let's be realistic. The FDA has not approved marijuana for anything. There is not one major medical organization that approves marijuana for anything. And the pro-medical marijuana people recently sued in federal court claiming that the FDA was not looking at the studies. And the federal judge looked at all the studies and said, you know what? There is not one study that says that medical marijuana helps any of these conditions. In fact, for glaucoma, medical marijuana can harm you because it initially causes an ocular pressure spike. So it's one big lie these people have perpetrated.
You know, I know the bottom line there is, I've seen a lot of good editorials on this, you know, people had high hopes of medical marijuana, but now it's like, go see who's actually getting the cards, and it's a bunch of young guys with back pain.
And 11% of the children who use marijuana illegally, based upon our state criminal justice survey, 11% of children get it from medical marijuana cardholders.
All right, there you go. And as you can hear from the music, we're wrapping up the show here, but I want to thank my guest, John Kavanaugh, for coming on the show. I wouldn't be too worried about that recall. I think we'll be seeing you around.
Well, even if I'm recalled, I'll still be here.
There you go. Trying to get back in.
It's a New York mouth. I don't get shut up.
All right. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
All right. This is Jack Wilczek on Independent Talk, 1100 KFNX.